Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's IRTP call on Tuesday, the 16th of November, we have James Bladle, Mike O'Connor, Baudouin Chombé, Kevin Erdman, Simonetta Bottega, Barbara Steele, Chris Chaplow, Bob Mountain, Ollie Hope, Barry Cobb, and from staff we have Marika Cornings and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. I don't see Marika on the line yet unless I've missed something. And we have apologies today from Anil George, Michaela Nalon, Matt Sterlin, and Michael Collins has resigned from the group. So could please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, James. Paul Diaz has also just joined.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you, Gisela. And I do note that Marika sent me a note that she might be just a little late joining this
yes.
call. So we'll probably expect her to join here in a few moments. So good morning, everyone, or good day if you're in your afternoon. I'm James, and I'll be the substitute teacher for Michele, who is, by the looks of his Facebook pictures, having a lovely time in Rome. So first order of business, you can see the agenda is there on for those of you that are able to get into Adobe Connect. The first order of business is to provide everyone an opportunity to update their statement of interest or make any declarations with respect to any changes in their interest. So going once, going twice on that. Any updates? Okay, moving on to agenda item number two is planning for the face-to-face meeting in Cartagena. Now, this may be more helpful with Marika on the phone.
Marika's just joined.
Oh,
I'm on the phone.
Speaking of timing, hello, Marika.
Hi, I'm still driving, but in a couple of minutes I'll be in front of my computer.
Well, just stay safe, and I'll read through what we have so far. It looks like we have a time slot on Thursday, the 9th, from 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. local time in Cartagena. And this is marked as a closed working group just for the members of the working group, so it's not a public workshop. And I guess the question is, does this work for everyone? How do we want to structure this this time? Do we want to make this a I think the simplest answer would be a face-to-face version of what we do on the telephone calls, or if there's anything specific that we would like to designate as an objective for this call. And I see Barbara's in the queue.
Hi, Barbara. I was just curious. I'm not planning to attend Cartagena. Will there be remote participation available?
A good question, and normally I think that that is the case, but I think I would defer to staff to understand exactly what facilities we'll have available for this closed meeting.
Okay. Yeah, this is Marika. I think we'll have the normal conference bridge and Adobe Connect available, so it shouldn't be a problem, apart from maybe the time difference.
Okay. Thank you.
And Barbara, I think for you, the time difference to Cartagena is plus 0 hours.
I was going to say 1 hour max, but that's thanks.
Okay, and then Mikey is next.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. You know, one of the things we might think about doing is using that face-to-face time to tackle our toughest issue, the ERTP thing, and actually depart from the normal approach and think about some sort of exercise or, you know, brainstorming thing, kind of like what we did in the first VI meeting in Brussels. Just a thought that one of the advantages to face-to-face is just that, that you can see each other and the interaction's a little different. And so we might want to take advantage of that. It's not a real strong opinion, but just a thought.
No, it's a good idea, and I think it acknowledges that we have postponed some of the discussions on EETRP, has tried to tackle some of the other some of the other topics and other charter questions, but if we feel like that's going to be a longer discussion, face-to-face might be good. I would note that the current time block is 1 hour. So I'm not sure if that's sufficient enough time. I would be concerned, or I would be nervous about postponing such a large issue for just 1 hour's FaceTime, but that's just my thoughts there. Bob?
Well, and just to follow up quickly, James, this is Mikey again. It might be that we'd want to do some prep work. I'm not. I agree. I don't think we necessarily want to postpone that issue. It's just I was thinking that there might be, you know, some prep work we could do, and then kind of finish it off in that face-to-face meeting. Sometimes, you know, by that time we will have had a lot of bar time as well, and so maybe a combination of social time at the meeting plus face-to-face to sort of tie it up would be good.
Sounds good. Bob, if I could go to Marika first.
No problem.
Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just on the issue of timing, the meeting basically finishes at the start of a scheduled break, so there is some flexibility, I think, to probably continue if needed. And I've also seen that there's no meeting scheduled in that same room even after that break. So if there's a real desire and no other conflicting meetings, the group has some flexibility there to go beyond the one-hour slot.
Excellent. Thanks. That's good to know. Bob?
This is Mikey again, just to jump in. Marika, should we sort of do a soft booking on that room just to hold it open so that we don't lose that slot?
This is Marika. I'm happy to ask to extend it. Would the group like to extend it to 11 then?
Yeah,
I think it depends on what's coming after that and what other folks may have in terms of conflicts.
Yeah. But maybe just for flexibility's sake, it would be good to get it reserved anyway.
Liz Marika, I'll ask if that's possible because we, you know, they have told us that they wouldn't make too many changes to the schedule following publication, but I guess this is a relatively minor one. And again, you know, with that flexibility, we can still finish the meeting within an hour if the group feels, you know, we're done, or if there are conflicting meetings taking place at the same time.
What if we requested, just jumping in here, looking at the whole schedule, there are a couple of meetings that run through that break at 11 o'clock, and what if we just extended this meeting from 9:30 to 11? An additional half hour, so it's not a whole lot, but at least it gets its you know, on the calendar for a little bit longer time than if folks need to stay over, that's open. Because I think there's quite a few things coming up at 11 that folks may want to attend, but if we at least schedule it through that break, if that's possible at this late hour. Okay, Bob, for real this time.
Okay. Yeah, this is Bob speaking. I think all the points have been made, but I just wanted to reinforce. I think it is a good opportunity to work some tough sessions or some tough topics like ETRP that are more difficult, you know, over the phone. I would think that as opposed to a general session, you know, we should have probably a more tightly defined agenda with potentially even a moderator, you know, specifically to prepare for that session to make sure we kind of maximize the use of the hour and a half or whatever we end up doing. And I fully agree with Mikey, you know, as much prep as we can do between now and then and advanced work would be, you know, I think also a really good thing towards making sure we get the most use out of our FaceTime. So that's all.
That's a good suggestion, and I'd like to hear more about what Mikey mentioned and how much of the vertical integration work could be used as a model for how they divided up into different groups and came up with different proposals and attempted to merge them and synthesize them. So, you know, that might be, you know, if you can maybe provide a synopsis of that on the list, Mikey, it might help us put some more structure around the face-to-face time if it's going to be focused on ETRP.
This is Mikey. I'm going to dive in and declare my incompetence. One of the things that I learned from the VI session is that while I am a brilliant and wonderful fellow in many regards, I'm not the best at these sort of intensely structured, moderated meeting kinds of things. And so the person that I actually relied on a lot was Ken Bauer, because he's actually got skills in this area. Marika, well, first to put it to the group, I don't know what people's reactions would be, but if I were in your shoes, James, and McKaylee's shoes as chair, given that we've got a little extra time, it would be nice to recruit somebody who actually knew what they were doing on this. And I'm happy to share what we did in the VI thing, but I did it sort of ad hoc, and I asked a bunch of smart people, and they all pretty intensely coached me on that. And it would be, I think, helpful if Marika, do you know if any of the Rob Hogarth, Ken Bauer-type folks are going to be at Cartagena and would be available to help us with this?
This is Marika. I think Ken is not attending. Rob will be there, but he has at the same time a geographic regions working group taking place. I would caution slightly towards the approach of creating breakout groups and you know, meeting in different corners, partly because this is a very small group to start with and not like the vertical integration working group where there were, I think, you know, 70 people subscribed to the mailing list and quite a number of people in the you know, at the meeting itself, and here it looks like we'll have quite a few participating remotely. And also it's very difficult to keep a record as it's, you know, not possible to record these different kinds of groups meeting. So I'm wondering, you know, personally, I think it might be more effective if we try to do a bit of preparatory work and you know, we've talked, for example, about doing a survey maybe on the different elements of the ETRP that might, you know, provide a basis for further discussion, because if we see that everyone agrees that certain elements should be there, you know, there's no need to discuss those maybe in so much detail, but maybe focus on those elements where there's difference of opinion or where we don't have sufficient detail and more work needs to be done. I don't know if that might be a way of actually preparing some of the work and really indeed take value out of that session. And a similar survey, because we spoke as well, that the survey might also serve in polling on some of the draft recommendations that were included in the paper, and there might be others that members of the working group would like to put forward as suggestions that might be included in such polling. So we get a bit of an idea of where we sit, and it might be easier as well in that way to identify where the remaining work of the group lies.
Okay, thank you, Marika. I was going to wrap up this agenda item. Mikey, is that an old hand? Or oh, there it went. Okay, so what I've captured here is the recommendation that the face-to-face meeting in Cartagena be extended by 30 minutes officially, so that it would run 9:30 to 11 local time, that it be a more structured discussion focusing on ETRP, that we define in advance what our preparatory work should be, that we have it moderated perhaps by staff, and we consider the idea of putting out a survey to test the various components or level of consensus for the various components or elements inside of the ETRP proposal. I'd like, if the group feels I've captured everything correctly, I'd like to get this sent to the list. There are a lot of folks who aren't present on today's call, including our chair, who may want to weigh in on these recommendations, and then we can maybe sign off on that, and then we'll have some a pretty decent game plan for what we're going to accomplish in Cartagena. So if there are any other thoughts on this item number 2 on our agenda, it was clear, and we are at 17 past the hour, starting agenda item number 3, which is a continuation of our review of the public comments received. Now, Marika, do you recall specifically where we left off on the comment review tool?
Yes, this is Marika. We left at comment number 8.
Comment number 8 under ETRP. Yeah, there we go.
Three.
And this is when they are labeled as Brussels meeting, these are the folks that commented at the microphone in Brussels, correct?
Yeah, this is Marika. These come from the notes that I circulated following that meeting. There were a number of people as well, including working group members that made comments, and I tried to capture those in a notes that weren't really attributed to anyone. I'm sure people can find it back if they go through the transcript and recording of the meeting. But those were the bullet points that I took from that meeting and that I thought might be useful to add here for the record.
Okay. And are you still in the car?
No, I'm not. I'm behind my computer.
Okay. Do you want me to read these, or would you prefer to do those?
As you want.
Okay. I think you have a much more pleasant voice, so if you wouldn't mind reading those, and then I'll manage the queue for comments and feedback if we start with number 8.
Okay. So comment 8 reads that the ETRP is reactive. Additional focus should be given to a proactive approach of preventing unauthorized transfers, example giving requiring a dual key before a transfer can be authorized.
And I see Bob is in the list. Go ahead,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, this is Bob speaking. I'm not sure if anyone had a chance to take a look at the aftermarket survey that Imanetta and I had sent out. This did come through pretty loud and clear. Not as much the reactive, but the proactive approach, and where numerous respondents were looking at some of the more advanced registrar security measures and viewing them positively. So certainly it's a small sample set. We only talked to 12 people, but many of them did, I think, emphasize this point as well. So that's all.
And looks like we've got quite a queue here. I'm going to go ahead and put myself at the bottom of that queue. Kevin, you're up next, sir.
Yeah, addressing the comment about preventing unauthorized transfers, if you recall, in an early draft of the ERTP, we had mentioned about having some sort of key approach or technical measure that would give presumptions in the ERT process. Those were ultimately taken out on the thought that it would impose an additional burden on registries, but in light of this comment, maybe that language should be revisited. That's my comment.
Kevin, do you remember specifically, was that in an earlier draft of ETRP, or was that?
I think it was in the original draft that our little subgroup first proposed, and then in the discussion and debate about the various items, that was one of the items that was discussed and then revised before we put out the final draft.
Okay. And maybe, I guess, would you be willing to see if you can take a look for that language specifically and post that to the list?
Sure. Yeah, I'll put that in.
Okay. Thank you. Mike, you're up next.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. Yeah, I think that the language that I'm remembering is the token language, and we had a discussion about some sort of token passing affair. Anyway, I was just about to take my hand down because pretty much what I'm going to say echoes what Bob and Kevin have said. I'd say yes, please. And I think that the proof is in the implementation. I think it gets complicated. If we can figure out a way to do it, I think that'd be great.
Okay, thanks. And Simonetta is next.
Yes, so as Bob was mentioning, this was really the focus of the feedback we got from the aftermarket survey, that people felt strongly that more can be done before you even get to the point where you have to deal with a hijacking situation. And I'm not sure, I wasn't part of the work group when you first initially discussed this language that was then taken out, that seems to have been a burden on the registries. But I think there's a lot of stuff that can be done at the registrar level in terms of just monitoring risk behaviors that could we could be putting forward as a recommendation, not necessarily as a policy must implement, but things like one registrar was mentioning to us that they have security questions that you need to answer in order to transfer out a domain name that is of high value to you. Similar stuff like, what was your dog's first name or middle name of your parental grandmother or whatever it is, things that you would need to know and couldn't as easily fake as getting access to someone else's Freemail account or something like that that you couldn't look up with a simple keylogger. And other ideas like that, and I got that feedback not just from the registrars, but also from individual domainers who were mentioning things like that as being done in the credit card world or in other situations. One person was mentioning phone card issues where all these things are basically done before you even start acting. And I know we do stuff like this here at CETO in terms of our certification requirements for people who are able to bid on names or place bids in the marketplace, where we are trying to establish some kind of a good or bad profile that enables or disables them to follow through with certain actions in our marketplace. So I think that piece, if we can come up with a list of recommendations, and that could be one of the items we can work on in Cartagena, could be a very nice additional resource for everyone in the space to help prevent hijackings in the first place.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and take and speak as a registrar in this regard. I agree completely with this comment. There are registrars, I think, that are doing different things with varying degrees of success and sometimes with an eye to their local market or their geographic region that they're serving. However, to my knowledge, a perfect or a foolproof system like this does not exist. There are still identity theft and spoofing attempts out there for every service, whether we're talking about domain names or online banking or email systems. So I guess my question to the group is, are we mistaken in thinking that these are mutually exclusive propositions, that we should not have both an increased emphasis, recommendations and best practices on proactive registrar security, as well as some mechanism to reverse a transfer that has been done in error or as a part of a fraud? And I'm thinking the analogy here is, you know, we can say to the credit card industry, you know, you should screen your applications and your customer transactions much better, but that doesn't completely alleviate the need for them to have chargeback mechanisms. So that's just my thought there, and I see the queue is filling back up again, so we'll go to Mikey.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. I just want to weigh in and support of what you said. I support this comment, but I don't view this as an either-or thing either. So just plus one would probably have been more succinct.
Okay, Bob, you're up.
Thanks. This is Bob. You know, the feedback was, you know, aftermarket's working pretty well. The concern about ETRP was that it was imbalanced, that it was too far, too much weight placed on the, you know, the remedy on a problem that isn't really that bad yet. So I think the balance is key, and I think the perception was that it was pretty far out of balance. Probably, my take is inversely out of balance, that the remedy would need to be a much smaller piece of the puzzle, and that the prevention would need to be a much bigger piece of the puzzle. That was my take, anyway.
Okay, thank you. And Barbara?
Hi, Barbara. I agree wholeheartedly with Bob and the others. I think there's actually room for both, and agree that the preventative best practices is really a critical piece, because to the extent that we can prevent the hijackings from occurring to begin with, obviously that's what we would want to do. With regard to the ERTP, I just have to reiterate that the registries, while I think we're agreeable to facilitating the process as much as we can, there is going to be, still a reliance on the registrars to and the data that they provide us in order to be able to take any action, because, at the end of the day, the relationship is between the registrar and the registrants. The registries really don't have visibility into that relationship. So, I think that what we can do at the registry level is fairly limited, basically just to, return the name if we do decide to go forward with an E, the emergency return policy. And then, as I said, there has to be a reliance, again, on the registrars and the data that they provide in order to tell us what needs to be done, because we just don't have that visibility.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. And I want to point out that Paul Diaz has posted a link in the chat box to the latest ESSAC report, that ESSAC 44, Registrant's Guide to Protecting Domain Name Registration Accounts. And I think that there's quite a bit of useful information there that if members of the group can review that in the context of this discussion of proactive best practices, that would be helpful as well. If I could weigh in just, I see the queue is empty, so I can wait and see if there are other folks that want to put their hand up. And again, I'm trying to play the role of devil's advocate without, necessarily defending ETRP or sounding like I don't support additional security measures. I do. But as Mikey said, the implementation is where a lot of these challenges lie. And, from our perspective, some of these recommendations have significantly different costs. We are in, as you are all aware, an environment where 25 cents or 50 cents difference in registration fees can make the difference in a customer choice. So selling a premium security service is sometimes not something that your customers are saying they want with their when they open their wallets. And once again, just wanted to point out that when we say that we're, wanting to make recommendations or best practices, we're leaving the door open to an uneven or an inconsistent application of those best practices or an interpretation of the ESSAC report, so that registrars in one market segment or one geographic location may behave in a certain manner, but others may behave differently. And the problem with domain name hijacking is that the hijackers know exactly who the weakest link in that chain is. They know which registrars close for certain holidays. They know which registrars are home-based businesses, perhaps, and someone in the hospital, et cetera. So, this is something that we just need to be aware of when we're making these recommendations, that we are also kind of expecting the registrars to exercise some judgment, which, not wanting to pick at an earlier conversation, but this is kind of what we're doing at GoDaddy with our 60-day lock. We consider that to be a sequence of transactions that raises our suspicion, and therefore we have some internal policies in place, and we catch a lot of grief for that. But this is one of those areas where we are trying to be more proactive and instill a greater sense of security into the system. Simonetta, I saw your hand go up and then go back down. Did you want to jump in?
I just had one additional thought on something you said earlier with, I agree with, I do think you need both. You need some kind of way to hopefully prevent them more, and I also think you need some mechanism to return a domain name. I think from all the feedback we heard from the aftermarket, the point where people had most trouble with is this piece of it that is basically, it's immediate and there is no recourse to it whatsoever. There is no way to state your case from the other side. I think that is where most of the emotional response is coming from. So if we can take a look at that piece and maybe figure out what can be done about that, it would make the whole aftermarket feel much more comfortable with this whole approach.
That's a good point, and I think that was one of the really I didn't spend more than 20 minutes going through that report this morning in preparation for the meeting, but I did see that there were a couple of key areas or components of the ETRP that really rose to the top as being at the head of the list of aftermarket concerns. And if there were some way, if we can find some way to address those, then I think that it would be a much more palatable proposition. Barry, you're next in the queue. Good morning.
Thank you, James. This is Barry. Just really a quick question and a comment to precede that question is I'm getting the idea that or the impression that what is going on out that there's not as many hijackings that are occurring out there in the marketplace. And then on top of it, if, you know, based on the feedback that we're getting on the ERTP, on the ETRP, that if we need to take a more proactive stance and that it, and if we came up with some kind of proactive methodology that implementing it would be difficult and or costly, I'm kind of beginning to wonder where, you know, the bang for the buck would be. So I go back. And I don't have the reference, unfortunately, for how IRTP got started, but I'm trying to, if somebody can refresh my memory for how the IRTPB decided to take on the ERTP, what data do we have that made us go down the road to create the ETRP? Do we have something very significant kind of data that said this is indeed a problem and that we should create a policy for it, or... I guess I just don't recall that, so if somebody could refresh my memory how we got into creating ETRP.
I'll take a swing at that, if you don't mind, you know, the fact that it is just that, a swing. This is based upon our first charter question discussing whether or not the need exists for an urgent return mechanism, and I think that included some discussion of existing mechanisms and whether or not they fit the bill for urgent return. And I think that we discussed the fact that those were rarely, if ever, used, the existing mechanisms, and so we then set off to put together what a more functional or useful return mechanism might look like. I think that a lot of registrars weighed in anecdotally, registrars and other folks, weighed in anecdotally about the hijacking issue, but this is probably an area where they're reluctant to share any statistics. So does that... align with how other folks remember it, or am I just, I mean, it was a while ago, so I'm admittedly probably fuzzy on that.
Thank you, James. I appreciate that. That helps because it's starting to give the impression that, I don't know, we're trying to attack a problem that doesn't yet exist extensively, and even though it does occur, at least based on... not to steal the thunder from the aftermarket survey report, but it does seem as though where we have come across hijacking cases that one way or another they are getting resolved, albeit may not be as pretty as we had liked it to be. So, all right, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, and if I could, actually there is a cue coming, but if I could weigh in, you know, I don't think anyone is saying that the incidence of hijacking is frequent so much that it can be compared to the, you know, daily transaction level, let's say, on all the aftermarket. But I think what we're saying is that when it does occur, the damage to that individual registrant can be significant, especially when you consider that it's high-traffic websites that are usually targeted for hijacking. So it's, you know, we're talking, you know, Alexa top 50 sites. And so just the, you know, even if we had an effective but slow return mechanism like TDRP, even that is not very useful because, you know, these folks measure their business impact in minutes or hours of downtime. So it's just another perspective there. I'm going to give a prerogative to staff and go with Marika first, and then we'll pick up Robin for it. Marika.
Thank you, James. This is Marika. In response to Barry's question and how this charter question got into the working group's charter, I think it might be helpful as well to look back at the issues report that basically outlines the process and the different discussions that were held on the IoTP issues, and that identifies as well some comments in relation to this issue. And I think this initially stems as well from the debate around the panics.com, and I think there's some links there to some exchanges that were had in relation to that debate, and also some recommendations that were made in, I think, another a previous ESSEC report in relation to what measures might be taken. So so it might be worth checking back there for the history on the issue.
Now, thank you, Marika. And I think that's a good point that you mentioned there at the end. Paul linked to ESSEC 044, which is a report on this topic, but it's also mentioned in, I think it's ESSEC 039 or 040, something in that. Rob, you're next. Rob, maybe on mute.
Sorry, didn't hear my name. Yeah, I mean, I went through the secondary market report and the general consensus from all but one who seems to have suffered hundreds and hundreds of hijacks and hijack attempts is that they're relatively happy with the existing processes, but they're viewing it not in the respect of hijacks, but largely in respect of sales gone wrong where they didn't get paid. So it's not so much a worry regarding the urgent return of the domain, because in those instances, those domains generally weren't being used and were up for sale. And they've cited time and time again through this that registrar-to-registrar interaction has been the best way that they've managed to get those issues solved and get their domains back. However, the times where we as a registrar have been involved in what we would term fraudulent transfers, they have almost all been disputes, if you like, between a web designer, who is the current admin contact, and the registrant, who is the user of the domain, over who can or can't change their websites, or who can and can't renew their domain, or things like that. And in those instances, we've had to actually end up getting the courts involved, because they've generally ended up getting transferred out to registrars who don't even want to reply, because the contact information of those registrars is just the designer, not, as was originally, the designer and the original registrant. So whilst the aftermarket survey overall feel is that they don't think there needs to be one, there are still issues where you want to get the domain back quickly whilst you sort out the legality. It took us 7 weeks to get control of the domain for a customer by going through the courts and involving the authorities in it, and that is too long for some businesses to be offline.
That's some excellent points there. Thank you, Bob. And I'm sorry, Rob. And
right.
Now if we could go to Simonetta, his name?
Yes. Thanks, Rob. I think that was a very good point. I think it may help us think about this if we think of in terms of categories of when does this actually apply. And I think the use case where I can really see that it would be very useful to have a very quick return of a domain name is in the case of, like, you have a business the size of a Facebook or a Microsoft or someone like that lose their domain name, and they really every hour counts. You want to be able to return that domain name to that business ASAP. at the same time, I really think those are exactly those type businesses who really don't care to pay an extra X amount of money on some kind of super lock or whatever security feature, because that website is so critical to their operations. And I really wonder if in other cases, you wouldn't almost always have a situation where you need to listen to both sides and weigh what the situation really is. And as Rob was just saying, oftentimes this has then actually had to go to some kind of a court. So I really wonder if we do ourselves a favor to enable a quick executed return to one party when the other side may have a very legitimate case to make themselves. And I don't know if a registrar would want to be in that spot where they basically have to decide which side to pick when they can really only listen to one of the two parties. I'm just wondering if it really is that great of an idea to just execute what one side is telling you.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. I wanted to respond to something that actually I think Rob had brought up earlier, but I'll go ahead and put myself in the back of the queue. And Paul, next.
Thanks, James. Appreciate everybody's comments. I mean, these are really good and should definitely be things extracted from the transcript for our final report. One thing that I just wanted to weigh in on, you know, how this all came, I guess, answering Barry's original question, was what's become very clear in the comments that have just been made by Oliver and by Simonetta. There is obviously a lack of consistent process in dealing with transfers that are in some way or shape or form disputed. And I think at least that's how I read part of our Charter A mandate. You know, is there a need for something like this? And if so, what would it look like? And ETRP, unfortunately, I think has sort of been set off on the wrong direction or distracted because people became so fixated on ETRP is only going to apply in a hijacking case, when admittedly these are not the most frequent things, frequent cases, but they can be very high profile. Use the Panix case, for example. More importantly, I think one of the root causes or root desires of ETRP is to come up with a process so that when you have an instance of a debate about a transfer, that there's a quick mechanism, a consistent mechanism, one that we can all look to, everybody can understand, it applies universally, to get the name back to the original registrar and then work it out. And so just following, you know, I was really keen with everything Simonetta said until the very end. I don't want to simply sit back and say, let the courts decide it, because I think all too often there you go with a very long process. Whether it's TDRP or the courts, those processes take a long time to work out. And for a registrant who claims that their name has been wrongfully transferred, that time period can be crushing. So, you know, maybe the ETRP, yes, there's a better balance that needs to be struck. There needs to be, you know, the focus on, you know, the proactive versus reactive. Okay, that's what this group should be focused on, but I don't want us to lose sight of there really is a need for a process that will bring some consistency to what, at a broader level, is a more common instance, challenged or questionable transfers.
Thanks, Paul. And I think that it's always good to understand, you know, where we're coming from with some of these things. That's why I think Barry's question was very apropos. Bob, you're next.
Yeah, this is Bob. I guess there are just thinking, and this may be a little bit too granular, but it almost seems there are two categories of domains we need to worry about. The Alexa top 50, you know, ultra high value sites that are based on a website that's getting, you know, millions of uniques. that it almost seems like that's a separate case, because there are absolutely, I think, you know, maybe the registrars can chime in, but there are ways to lock that type of domain down. That type of domain is not for sale, usually, unless the business is, right? Facebook isn't going to sell Facebook.com. They might buy FB.com, but they're, you know, so there are registrar locks, registry locks, you know, ways to really lock that down so it's not going to be hijacked. It might be a little different with a domain that's owned by a domain investor or a marketplace, because that domain might be high value, very extremely high value, but also needs to be sold. So there's, I think, where the balance, where the, you know, where the security measures that are in place can't or shouldn't necessarily affect the fluidness of the market, that domain is ultimately in a position where it is to be sold. You know, the other thing is that these ultra-high-value domains are probably not a candidate for a fast transfer type sale. So, again, the security for these ultra-high-value is probably in a different category, you know, than I think some of the other domains they're, you know, that we all think about, where, you know, thousands of these sales happen every day. Security needs to be much more balanced with an aftermarket, a fluid, fast transfer aftermarket. So I guess, you know, I kind of, sorry for the rant, but I guess the question I would have is, do we really feel that there are not sufficient mechanisms today to lock down an ultra-premium name, or are those security provisions available, and do they just need to be communicated more to the, you know, to these domain owners?
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I see your point and what you're getting at with those names that are unlikely to be transacted. I certainly would be reluctant to write something into policy that draws, you know, distinctions in different classes of names, because even though someone may have a what's determined to be a low-value, low-traffic name, it's important to them. And so, therefore, they would be upset if it were hijacked. But I see your point about the ones that are less likely to be to have the need for portability and, therefore, can benefit from some extra security. I don't have a good answer for your question directly. I just wanted to chime in here a little bit, and this is something I brought up, I think, earlier in the working group, and I think that in light of the aftermarket survey results, maybe it bears repeating. I think that we're at a fundamental difference of, I don't want to say difference of opinion, because it's not like folks are, you know, being argumentative, but it's more of a difference of perception, in that registrars see IRTP and they see transfer and they see registrar-to-registrar transfer. Aftermarket participants say IRTP transfer means transfer between registrants, so it's more of a transactional operation. So naturally, when something like ETRP is proposed, registrars see it as an operational function, and the aftermarket folks would naturally perceive that as something closer to a dispute mechanism. And so I guess my question is, you know, is that difference, you know, coming at this from different directions, is that the root of what we're trying to address here? And are we, you know, if we were to sit down for an hour and a half in Cartagena and tweak out ETRP or throw it out the window or do whatever we did down there, would we be kind of missing, you know, as a group, would we all kind of be missing the point that there's this fundamental difference of how transfer is perceived and how it is being used? So I don't know if you know, there's an answer forthcoming to that. I just wanted to put that out there as, you know, we don't have this operation that trades names from entity A to entity B. So we're kind of, we're using the transfer for that purpose, which I don't know that that's necessarily always the case. You could use, for example, if both customers were within GoDaddy, we have a change of account procedure. So IRTP isn't involved at all. I think that, we need to kind of get a better understanding, or maybe get our minds around a little bit this idea of this, how different parties use the IRTP process for different things, and how, therefore, solution to the problems of one party are not going to be seen as solutions to the problem of the other party, and vice versa. Mikey, you're up. And, we're getting a cue here. Let's get through the cue that we have, and then we will probably need to adjourn for the day. We have 6 minutes left in our call. Mikey.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. Just two real quick points. One, to sort of amplify what you were just saying, which is this notion that what we're talking about is getting the domain back to the registrar it originated from. And the key point there that we talked about in the earlier part of the discussion was move quickly to restore the domain to its prior state and then allow time for dispute mechanisms to resolve the actual dispute. So that's point number one. And then point number two is to remember that distinction I made last week, which is the distinction between good guys and bad guys. If there is a good guy on the back end of the transaction, things are likely to unfold in a really different way than if there's a bad guy. And maybe we can figure out a way to get this built where the bad guys simply will disappear and the good guys being there is a way for us to distinguish use cases. That's it for me.
Okay, thank you, Mikey. And I think that's a good point, is that, each year, transfer, or let's say, ETRP is a dispute about where a domain lives, not necessarily who controls it. There are other mechanisms, or if there are, there should be other mechanisms for disputes over who controls a mechanism, or who controls a domain name. So we were looking to, and maybe that the ETRP fails to address it, and that's something we can discuss further. Simonetta?
I was originally going to say something else, but I like where your thoughts are going with this. If you return, for example, if you restore the previously set DNS, that would immediately enable the functionality of any kind of website again. And you could, for example, put the domain in a account, maybe even with the original registrar that isn't the same one that it used to be housed in, until you have a way to have the other site state their case. And then you could either leave it there until the dispute has been solved by court XYZ, or you could return the domain name once it turns out that, yes, this was really a hijacking situation. That was comment number one. But the one that I really also wanted to make was, and this is just a brainstorm, I don't know if this is feasible, if you could somehow flag names that are listed for sale in an aftermarket, and this would be kind of like some notification mechanism that goes out to whoever the admin C is of that name that's just been listed for sale in an aftermarket like Xedo or Biodomains or Afternic, so that you guys have some indication, okay, this domain has just been listed for sale. That may give that registrant a chance to respond and say, hey, no, I'd never wanted to list this domain for sale. Or you could look at stuff like, okay, we have just had a change in admin C email address, and now we get this flag domain has been listed for sale. Maybe we should take a look at the situation right now. That I'm not sure how this would work operationally, but this could solve the issue. And you could also say, okay, if someone had been flagged, if this name had been flagged as listed for sale, no one responded to, or maybe the registrant has even responded and said, yes, I want to list this name for sale, then this person can come back 3 months later and say, no, I never meant to have this domain name be transferred, because you have a very good indication in the first place that this person agreed to sell. So this is just a brainstorm. I'm not sure how this would work, but this could solve the issue of the seller's remorse case, where you, as a registrar, would have some kind of way to know, okay, this is likely not a hijacked domain name, but this person has agreed to sell in the past.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. And I think that there's definitely some value there. Whether that's a policy or a new business model, or maybe you just invented a whole new type of aftermarket function, since we have to. But we will have to hold the comments for today. I will let Mr. Nayla know that we got through number 8. That was our achievement for today. I think that the rest of the comments are more incremental. I don't think that they necessarily reopen these debates. Well, I guess if we don't allow them to, they don't necessarily have to reopen a lot of these well-worn topics, and then maybe they just add new perspectives and perceptions to some of the things we've already discussed. There's one other item here, and I know that we're just 1 minute past the hour, there's one other item here, which is that my takeaway for from our last call, we noted that we were going to push this PDP to conclude at the at or around the San Francisco meeting, which is less than 220 days away per our milestones laid out in our charter, and that therefore we wanted to communicate that to council. I did go back to our council representative, Tim Ruiz, our council liaison, who mentioned that, I did discuss the fact that Mikey and Bob and someone else were working on an updated work plan with revised milestones. And so I wanted to give Mikey an opportunity to speak to that real quickly. And then if we can get that posted to the list and everybody can sign off on it, then we can deliver that to Tim to take it to council. Does that sound good, Mikey?
This is Mikey. That's fine. I think that we just actually Bob did it. I'm doing the royal we. Just posted a first draft work plan to the list yesterday late in the day. And you'll see in the language that it's very Mikey-esque language. We probably want to tune up the language just a little bit. But what we wanted to do is get this out in front of you all to see if this approach is right, and maybe weave Marika into our little group to help us with some of the backdating stuff, so that maybe. I don't think this is quite ready to communicate to the council.
Okay.
But we wanted to see if we were on the right track, and then if we are, we could tune it up just a little bit so that it wasn't quite so casual. Basically, the idea that we had was that we would take the major blobs of work and sort of do a little sequence of steps under each one. And as I look at it, I think there's the possibility of doing some work in parallel. And then once the 4 or 5 or 6 major blobs of work are finished, then we have a single-track work plan to get the report out. We didn't know whether we needed to go back out to public comments again. That was a question for Marika. So if people could take a look at the first draft very quickly, with really two things in mind. One is, do we have the right major blobs of work out there? And then, two, does this first try at an approach feel like it'll work? And get comments back to the list by say, Thursday, you know, put a little bit of time pressure on this, then Bob and Michaela and Marika and I can turn around a cleaner draft for next week that could then be suitable to send up to council. That's kind of where we're at.
Okay. Sounds like a good plan. Mikey, you know, if we can set a deadline to have some folks respond to that.
James, can I maybe respond?
Marika, go ahead.
Because, Mikey, I don't think it has gone out to the list yet, or maybe I've missed it, but I did receive an email from Bob asking for comments, and I actually provided him with some input already on your draft, because I think there's some items there that probably don't need to be there and some other issues. Because I had actually sent, because I wasn't sure anymore who are working on that and whether the little sub-team had already met, because I'd actually sent out a template that was used for other working groups to Michaela and James ahead of this meeting, and I also shared that with Bob, where it's a bit of a different approach. It basically focuses more on the meetings and aligning work with the meetings, you know, heading up to the deadline, and actually doing that, you know, just for the group's information. And if we take all the meetings between now and the publication deadline for the San Francisco meeting, we have 11 calls noting, you know, providing that we would meet on a weekly basis, not taking the time between Christmas and New Year. So it's a relatively short time frame. So, you know, I think it would be very helpful if we can put this work plan together. And I commented to Bob as well, because I saw that one of the categories you've identified was the person responsible for each task. That might help us moving things forward if we clearly identified who is doing what and by what meeting or what time frame things need to be delivered if we're really committed to meeting that deadline for San Francisco.
Thanks, Marika. This is Mikey again. Just real quick, I just realized that I was looking at the wrong email from Bob, and you're right. It hasn't gotten to the list yet. I was just testing you, and you passed the test with flying colors.
I'll forward you as well my comments to him, because I wasn't sure anymore who were involved in that little subgroup, so I'll send them to you as well, so you have that as well.
Yeah, it's right now it's Bob, McKaylee, and me, and now hopefully you. And so, James, why don't we leave this that we'll circle back to the group by next week with a revised version of this thing, and forget the go out to the list.
Okay. All right, thanks, Mikey. That's noted, and I appreciate everyone sticking around for a couple extra minutes, and I apologize for running late. We'll follow up with McKelly and debrief him on what we discussed today, and otherwise, thanks for your time.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James. Great job.
Great, James. Thanks.
Thank you, Miriam. Enjoy the rest of your day.